We are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brown-Eal. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. The killing of Michael Brown and Eric Gardner started a discussion about race relations in America in the news and on social media. On a personal level, we have seen friendships explode and others cemented around these issues. The personal has become even more political since the killing of Officer Wenjian Liu and Rafael Ramos in New York City. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, host David Bell talks with Melissa Haisley, an educational psychologist who is part of the psychological faculty at Penn Valley Community College, about how many in the African-American community view the police and why. We will open the phone lines for you to make your comments and ask questions. Please make your comments respectable and to the point so that we may answer as many questions as possible. There will be no calendar of events this week, but we will play the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. We will also want to thank today's engineer, Jen Zaman. Stay tuned after these messages for David and Melissa.
Good morning. My name is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. Today is a call-in show. Our number is 816-931-5534. Today's show is entitled It's Black and White, and it's about what we're saying about Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, and Tamir Rice behind closed doors, and how do we explain such radically different viewpoints. My guest today on the show is Melissa Haisley. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
And if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, and we're going to step right into the issues of today.
Well, professionally, I'm an educational psychologist. I've worked also in higher education for a number of years, and I am active in the Kansas City community around community and social issues.
Great. So let's get right into it. And Melissa and I had a number of discussions off the air about this, and we're going to go right into Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, and Tamir Rice. And again, this is when the doors are closed, when we think no one's listening, when whites are talking to whites and blacks are talking to blacks, what's being really said behind the scenes? Because the topic of race is such an explosive issue, as we've seen on the street, as we've seen all throughout the news and society today, that sometimes people are hesitant to express their true views for whatever reason. And so today we're going to try to peel that back, not just expressing the views, but really trying to understand from a psychological perspective where these views come from. Let me tell you some things I've heard behind closed doors, Melissa, and I'd like you to respond. Okay. With regard to Michael Brown, this is the Ferguson incident. I've heard he was a thug based on how he treated the convenience store guy. He stole cigars. He shouldn't have been walking in the middle of the street. He was high on drugs. And why didn't he just do what the police said? That's what I've heard behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Tell me what's underlying that thought process and why, from people that I like, people that I have a relationship with, why I may be hearing comments like that.
Well, in my opinion, it really is an effort to create a narrative that both devalues some lives and also makes it acceptable, makes the outcome acceptable. So what I'm hearing in terms of Michael Brown's behavior is that was, you know, nothing more than an effort to paint him in a certain light, so that now you make him capable of being the person that the police officer believed he was, you know, someone that needed to be subdued, totally overpowered. And so, you know, that's kind of how I'm hearing it talked about, is those things are just a series of excuses.
And when you say excuses, excuses for what? How is it that when we're generalizing here, ladies and gentlemen, we understand mm-hmm. that. I don't represent every white person in the world, and Melissa doesn't represent every black person in the
Certainly
world.
Certainly not.
We're doing the best we can with the time we've got based on our experiences and our knowledge. But how is it that the white community then is seeing Michael Brown, for example, and you're saying you're hearing it from a different perspective? Mm-hmm. There's a mismatch there. There's some disconnect. What's the difference in how the communities are seeing Michael Brown?
Well, for example, the convenience store situation. Inappropriate behavior. But missing from the conversation is that he is a teenager. He's a young man. We know from biology as well as the study of psychology, that teenagers, adolescents make poor decisions. That's why they have more car accidents than any other age groups. They take risks. They do things that are, you know, risky and that an adult with more experience would not do, because surely they've done similar things in the past. So when you look at the behavior of Michael Brown at the convenience store, you look at that as, okay, that was a bad decision. That's, he shouldn't have shoved the clerk. That's what I remember seeing in the video. But that also doesn't mean that he's to be gunned down in the street and laid there for several hours unattended.
So let's move then to Eric Gardner. You know, one of the things I'm hearing there is, why didn't he just follow the police commands? Why did he struggle? And so what are you hearing? And, great. And again, just a reminder, this is a call-in show, 816-931-5534. So again, Eric Gardner, mm-hmm. background, I see on TV, he seems to be a larger man. Mm-hmm. I definitely see that. He seems to be being told by the police to submit to their authority. Why didn't he just follow the commands? Why did he struggle? Those are some of the things I'm hearing. What's your response to that? What viewpoint or what the way in which we view society and people of different colors, different ethnicities, what's behind that viewpoint those are the first things that are pointed out about that situation?
Okay, well, what I'm hearing in terms of, you know, you mentioned his size. I actually had a student a couple of semesters ago who has some tall, bigger sons, and he's a bigger person as well. And he shared with me, you know, problems that he's having with his son at school and just how his son is approached. And they call him a gentle giant, you know, and they kind of label him as this person who's capable of doing superhuman things, you know, and so they just really interact with him in an aggressive manner. He's not allowed to, like I said, make adolescent mistakes, you know, because he looks like an adult. And so I really see a parallel with what that parent was explaining to me about raising his child and how his child is viewed by teachers and administrators at the school. And, you know, that was his personal experience. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of what's happening at the school. But you look at someone like Eric Gardner, and it reminds me of those signs that people held during civil rights movement. Okay, during civil rights movement, where it's I am a man. And so what I'm hearing is, why do the police approach certain people and expect them to be completely submissive and compliant? Now, I'm also hearing that black men in particular are taught how to interact with the police. Show your hands. You know, don't make any sudden movements. Be very, very compliant. You know, that these are kind of the instructions that are given. But, you know, I'm hearing the flip side as to why is the police officer continually trying to get this person, this suspect, you know, to just be totally submissive and going to just take him down. Like, why is that the response to this person who's selling loose cigarettes?
I'm saying it's a petty crime, if a crime at all. And why is this kind of extremely aggressive behavior even being presented into the situation?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, yeah. And this is an American citizen. You know, this is not an animal. You know, this is a human being capable of discussion. You know, and we've had some cases where police have been overly aggressive toward folks that have mental issues as well. So we're asking, well, what training are the officers undergoing to where they can't deal with people and they can't talk with people in a human one-to-one, you know, level? You know, why do you escalate, you know, the situation right there on the street corner?
All right. And I think we have a caller. Caller, please state your name and what part of town you're calling from.
My name is Nathan Davis. I'm calling from Lenexa.
And what is your comment today?
Well, I find it interesting that the female on the show is discussing the list of facts in the Michael Brown case in Ferguson as excuses or a narrative creating a thug-like character. Mm-hmm. When you saw him rob the store, you saw him physically assault the owner. They admittedly were walking down the middle of the road. And she says all of these things are because he's a teenager making poor decisions. But yet when the officer arrives, that community says, well, he made all the right decision when the officer arrived. I don't think anyone's creating excuses or a narrative. Those are the facts. Unfortunately, those are being overlooked. So why are these all these facts being overlooked and excused as he's a teenager making a poor decision. Don't you think he could have continued making poor decisions when the officer asked him to exit the middle of the road?
I see. So, caller, and that's a good point, and let me thank you very much for calling. Let me just, if I can summarize the caller's viewpoint. If you have a young man who continually appears to be breaking the law and making poor decisions, mm-hmm. then isn't it fair to assume that at the moment of the interaction with the police officer that Mr. Brown continued to make poor decisions, thereby leading to the shooting and the death? What's your response to that?
Well, the grand jury made their decision, so we certainly don't have to retry that, right? So obviously whatever they heard, the evidence that and testimony that was presented to them, they made an outcome, you know, they made a decision that they felt was warranted. I'm simply talking about the narrative that is created to help us accept the outcome of this young man's death.
And so Melissa,
I'm not minimizing his misbehavior at all. I'm saying that this helps us swallow the fact that it's very possible that he deserved to die that day.
Right. And again, I don't want to get too much in the facts or the dispute of the facts. The question, I guess, and this is by this caller, proposed at least from my perspective, is why is it that the white community, and I'm generalizing, don't send letters in about this, I'm just saying what it is, why is the white community focusing on those behaviors, whereas the black community is coming at it from a completely different perspective? Meaning, so the white community is saying essentially what that caller said is, well, he was a thug, he did this, he did this, he did this, surely he behaved in a consistent manner with how he behaved in the past when he interacted with the police officer. Why is that the focus of a particular community? That's really the issue. And you're saying what? That helps to justify or make it easier for me to accept the fact that we have a young man laying dead in the street? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, look, no one wants to look in the mirror and come to the realization that they're a horrible person. Like, nobody wants to do that. You want to gather a set of facts that then make the outcome make sense. Like, you want to do that naturally as a human being. We all do. What I'm saying is that I don't see the instances that led up to his behavior being equal to what happened to him.
I see.
That's what I'm saying. They're not insignificant, but they're certainly not equal.
Okay. And again, this is a call-in show. It's 816-931-5534. And so now I want to go to the next instance. Tamir Rice, and let me lay the framework for this. I want to remove the pot smoking thug image that was, you know, that we have some people claiming was Michael Brown. I want to remove from the situation this what appears to be a larger male from the situation. And now, so I want to take all that away. And now all we're talking about is a 12-year-old kid. Right, so we've taken away drugs, we've taken away convenience store, manhandling some guy, we've taken away big guy, now we've just got a young black kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we have the one thing remaining that I'm hearing on this one is, why was he waving the gun around? But if you could respond generally to that.
Well, again, you have a situation where, you know, you just have a certain narrative in place. And the media, you know, you watch CNN or, you know, those shows that have a whole lot of airtime and they're able to really create a story for you, you know, and really be able to give you, you know, fill in the gaps for you and help you kind of conceptualize what happened. But, you know, you have the same situation where you have a kid. Even the caller said, you know, it's probably not a gun. It's probably a toy. You know, can you just come and check it out? Is my understanding of when the caller called the police. So the police roll up, you know, and they just immediately, now I don't even think they stopped the car according to the video, and they just immediately just ambush, gun down this kid. And it's like, okay, well, if you think he has a gun and you think he might start shooting people, it's very much possibility he could shoot you, the officer. So why don't you post up? Back away, you know, get behind your car, get on your loudspeaker, make some announcements, give the kids some instructions, you know, and secure the area. You know, you don't immediately and just open fire like that. You never do that in any other situation. But again, I think we have this narrative where we're able to look at a young black kid or African-American kid, and we're able to imagine all of the things that they might be capable of.
Caller, what's you're on the air. What's your name?
Hello, this is Tiffany from Midtown.
Tiffany, what part of town are you calling from? I'm sorry, you said that. And what's your comment today?
Well, my comment was about some of the conversation earlier. Why is it that the media could be portraying, or many may view folks like Eric Garner as thugs, or Michael Brown as thugs? And I think it's important to introduce the historical demonization of the African-American people over a period of time, which has instilled a level of fear that has historically been perpetrated, whether in thought, in media, in stories that families may share around dinner time during the holiday season. There historically has been a demonization, particularly of African-American men over time, that hasn't been addressed. And I think that is a missing factor of the conversation. But then also, we have to look at the data. What these shootings are showing us is that we're getting at the touchy-feely part of the slayings of these individuals. But then if we start looking at numbers, people cannot dispute data. And what the data is saying is that the misuse of force, it affects us all, but it just so happens to be disproportionately affecting many who are black and brown and live in the urban environments. And I think those are important things to consider, because if we focus on the individuals, we then will start picking apart the facts,
right,
and then we will go to the fear to demonize the person versus looking at, this is revealing that that there are disproportionate numbers of people being affected, and they just so happen to look like Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, and Eric Garner.
Those are my comments. Thank you very much, Tiffany, for your call. And Melissa, let me direct that to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the three cases here, and I want to do what the caller is suggesting, I want to step back for a sec and kind of the bird's eye view of everything. The common thread is African-American male, and that's really it. And then I guess what is this underlying narrative that is causing individuals, or what must the underlying narrative be in order for society to be able to essentially to go to bed at night and have these things happen? What's the underlying narrative about African-American males?
Well, you have to establish that they are dangerous. You have to establish that they're unpredictable. You have to establish that they're stronger than you, David, you know, as a white male.
Right.
You're definitely going to lose in that situation. You have to establish a set of premises that allow you to basically stand your ground, so to speak.
Right.
You have to establish that. And this is how you do it. I mean, even though, you know, we are talking about, I agree with the caller, Tiffany, we are talking about these individual cases. And so when you start talking about individual cases, then you have to start debating the facts of these individual cases. But if you back up and take a bird's eye view, you then see a pattern that's hard to argue with. I mean, you see a pattern where police officers are interacting with African-American males and females. We're not talking too much about female victims of, you know, this narrative of being dangerous or being able to take care of themselves. We had the young woman who went and knocked on the door asking for help in the middle of the night and was shot dead on the porch.
Yeah.
So you also have this narrative of strength, you know, that they don't need help necessarily. This is how you get approached. You know, you get approached like you're not there to be protected. You know, you're there to be subdued. And so that I think this is the narrative. And I'm not saying that, okay, let me also say I'm definitely not anti-police, and I'm not saying that all police officers behave in this manner. I don't believe that at all. If I have a problem in my house, I will call the police. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What I'm saying is that we have a few officers within several departments that, you know, we need to remove.
Right.
You know, these individuals are not, you know, having an easy time of dealing with the people that they're supposed to police and protect. And so, you know, you have this crop of individuals that we kind of need to weed out, because so that the good officers are left there, you know, to do their jobs appropriately.
All right. Thank you. Caller, you're on the air. What is your name and what part of town are you calling from?
Taylor from Midtown.
Taylor from Midtown. What's your comment?
It's interesting to hear everyone blame police, and no one's talking about communities or parents. You got 12-year-olds who think it's okay to go out and wave fake guns in public. you got people whose mentality is 187 on a cop, and that people think that someone's trying to demonize the black man, when if you look at any black social or media, it's all negative. I mean, the rappers are the biggest thing in the black community, and all they talk about is Murder, Inc. and Bad Boy and all this and all this, and you're taught this thug mentality, and everyone worships Tupac, and they demonize police. And you're creating an entire generation of people that hate police and think it's okay to tell the cops to go F off when they tell you to stand down or follow the rules of society. And parents say it's okay to teach their children to be gang members. That it's okay. You don't hear anybody protesting gang violence.
But Carl,
burning down cities because of, well, a few incidents because of a few bad cops. But look what they're dealing with.
But Carl,
people they're trying to police, and they're taught from a young age, you don't have to listen to cops, and you can tell them that you're going to shoot them, and it's okay.
Okay. Well, hold on. I want to ask you one question. What about the idea that, to a certain extent, we are brought up, society in general brought up, to demonize the black male? I don't think anybody's talking about police being bad generally, any more bad than any other profession or any other people in society. But what about the idea that the images seen over and over and over again of the black male create, at least in society other than black, like white, for example, suggests that I see black and somehow that raises my anxiety level even just a little bit. Maybe I don't even realize it at the time, or I feel just slightly threatened, or maybe I check my door to see if it's locked in the car, or whatever it is. What about that as a possible at least contributing factor?
Are you suggesting like stereotypes? Because if you look at the amount of crimes committed, who's committing those crimes, what communities have the highest rate of violence and drugs? What communities have the highest amount of people toting guns?
I see. All right. Well, caller, thank you very much for the call. And Melissa, I'd ask you to just in general respond. The caller, obviously very passionate, you know, I think well-intentioned. What is it that's being reflected in that view?
Well, I'm 28 years old, so I don't have any recollection of the 60s Watts riots, and I don't have any recollection of segregation. What I have recollection of is all the African-American kids in my high school and college all wanted to act like thugs. They dressed like gangsters. They talked like they didn't have an education. They wanted to fight all the time. They pretended they were in gangs. They listened to the violent, disgusting rap music loudly and sang it in the hall. They used the N-word openly in public, and then they damned everybody around them because everything was everyone else's fault. You wear your pants around your knee, you got a tattoo on your neck that says thug life, and you drop the N-bomb, you're creating that image. No one's demonizing you. You've created a character that you want society to recognize and fear. That was your choice.
Right. Caller, thank you very much for your viewpoint. We're going to take the next caller real quick, and then I want to ask Melissa to respond. Caller, you're on the air. What is your name, and what part of town are you calling from?
Oh, I'm Bill. I'm from
You're Bill, and from where?
Wyandotte County, right across the state line.
Okay, I've heard of it. All right, what's your question or comment?
My question is to your guest. Why would you concede that there are good cops as opposed to bad cops? When you put on this uniform, and I have experience with that, when you put on the uniform, you're no longer anything other than what that uniform represents. And in that case, people start, you know, involving themselves in groupthink. And sometimes when people start involving themselves in that sort of thinking, where basically they don't think, they just do what the group says, it's not the brightest outcome. It's never the good outcome. I would never concede that point. I think that when there is, this power with dominance that's a holdover from the past, and in the case of America, we have this peculiar history. A large portion of the ancestors of large portion of the demographics of this country were enslaved, and there are people that I'll never forget that sort of degradation or shame or someone trying to make you that low. That's never going to happen, and some people just need to get over that. But back to the part about being in uniform, people have difficulties with something contemporary, the San Diego fans, as opposed to the Chiefs fans. So why wouldn't people with guns that already have this sort of mentality, why would they not engage in racist and and dominant psychotic behavior. Why wouldn't they do that? And then here's my last point. Mm-hmm. My last point. Why are there people within their department defending them as opposed to ridding themselves of that? If they're worried about that image, my first thought would be, I don't want to be associated with this racist idiot that beats people and robs people. Wow.
Okay.
Why aren't people called to account on that?
Caller, you've raised some great points. I want Melissa to make a brief response, then we're going to go to break, and then when we come back, I want her to be able to respond, because I think you bring up some really wonderful points. Thank you for calling. Melissa, briefly, then we'll go to break, and then when you come back, I'd like to hear more.
Okay. Well, I want to kind of respond to the person who called in and mentioned Tupac, since, rap music, you know, that is also a good a fallback. It's a good way to conceptualize the behavior that people feel is overwhelmingly representative of black men and black people. The albums that were mentioned were quite narrow. I think you mentioned some Tupac, you mentioned some NWA with their F the Police famous anthem. But that's narrow. So I want to give you some other artists to take a look at. Common is one, C-O-M-M-O-N. You can also check out Talib Kweli. That's with a K. Kweli is with a K, K-W. And then Mos Def is another, M-O-S-D-E-F. All these folks are on Twitter, too. So if you want to follow them and check out some of their discography, you know, that's readily available at the edge. But I think that's important to just point out that there is a vast amount of music in the African American community. You can't forget jazz. You know, we have a lot of different genres that have a lot of different messages. Now, whether you choose to look at certain artists who may say something offensive, and then you have people who want to kind of jump onto that, you know, that's your choice. But there are other things out there that you can look at that will give you a broader view of African-American people.
Melissa, thank you. During the break, I'm actually going to tee up my Predator album by Ice Cube. go ahead, and we'll see you right after the break. Great. You're back with Jaws of Justice. This is David Bell, host. I'm here with Melissa Hasley. We have a caller on the line, and then I want Melissa to respond to our last caller. Caller, you're on the air. What is your name, and what part of town are you calling from?
Good morning.
Yes. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name, and what part of town are you calling from?
My name is Larry. I'm calling from Midtown.
All right. What's your comment today?
Yes, I want to respond to the about the little kid in Ohio getting shot at 12 years old.
Yes.
And some guy was the young man called in and said the little kid was waving a gun around. If the gun was real or not real, it doesn't matter. I think when two adults go where kids are playing the park at, I don't know if you can go there and start shooting guns right away. This is a boy got died in less than a minute.
Right.
I mean, people be held up in the house. They talk to people in houses trying to get them out of the house for sometime all day before they kill anybody. Now, how'd they go to this park and kill a 12-year-old child? I don't believe that would happen over the park. I really don't. I'm sorry. The thing is, you're not talking about the real thing here.
Right.
You keep bouncing over the real thing here, man. The thing is, man, we got a race problem in this country here. And when you got cops going around killing little kids at 12 years old, man, we got a problem. It's a lot of things they could have done without killing that little kid. A lot of things they could have done. I'm very disturbed about that. If these guys get set free, like the mother two cops got set free, I won't be really. I really don't believe in the system that much at all. But this when that little boy got shot in the park, I was through believing in the system. I really was.
Well, okay.
So have a good day.
Caller, thank you so much for your call. And Melissa, I think, and going back to responding to that caller about the Tupac and about the Ice Cube and about all those things, NWA, which, interestingly enough, as I joked about, I do own those albums, so I don't know what it appears like when I am driving down the street listening to that music. But what the caller is suggesting, and I think what the recent one and the past one is, the only way you can justify this is if you somehow demonize the 12-year-old boy. If you could respond to that, and I know you had some comments about the prior caller as well.
Well, I mean, again, this is a kid, and the last caller, I tend to agree with that. You have situations where you have standoffs with people where they're patient and they talk them down and they do all these other things before they choose to just kill a person. And I think, you know, in our psyche, you know, we've arrived at a place where it is okay for a cop to shoot a 12-year-old, and we justify it by saying, oh, who's waving around a gun in a park, and why didn't his parents teach him? Kids play cops and robbers all the time. Mind you, these products are available for purchase. So I'm sure that there's not a factory somewhere where they're making guns, toy guns. You know, this is a product that's available to people.
So if you're saying if you take the 12-year-old Tamir Rice, and you have a 12-year-old white kid, you know, David Smith or whatever you want to call it, and they both give him the same gun, the same toy gun, and take that little orange cap off, is society going to view one of those two more threatening, everything else being equal?
Yeah, and the closest an analogy you can think about are gender roles. So you know how we have culturally created gender roles, male and female. Males act this way, girls, you know, females act this way. So we have these gender roles. We've kind of did something like that with race. You know, black people act this way, white people act that way, you know, and it's really a pathological dysfunction that we have between each other. I mean, our caller shared with us, you know, his classmates going down the hallway rapping vulgar rap music and being taught to disobey the police and being taught to be thugs and taught to join gangs. That's just not a reality that I understand in the black community that I've lived in for the whole of my life. I mean, I don't know anyone that was taught to be a thug by their parents. I don't know anyone that was encouraged to join a gang. I don't know anybody that was told to be defiant from police officers because you will be killed. Which is what we're seeing now. You don't even have to be defiant. You could just be a kid in a park.
Well, and I think that's a good point. I was just thinking, as you mentioned about the rap song, another album I had was Metallica, a number of Metallica albums, and one of the names of their album is Kill 'Em All, which is, I think Metallica would be considered more white than black. We have another caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and what part are you calling from? What part of town are you calling from?
Hi. Am I on there?
Yes, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
My name is Felicia, and I'm calling from Wyandotte County.
Okay. And what's your comment today?
I wanted
today?
To comment on the gentleman that she was just speaking on, the one that had such ground and concrete views of black people as a whole. I mean, he really generalized, and, you know, people's beliefs are based on what they've seen. I agree with that, and, you know, it's unfortunate that he went to school with that particular niche of the type of people, some of the type of people in our community. But, you know, did he not see any academic blacks at his school? Did he not see any good, well-behaved blacks that didn't listen to rap, that didn't listen to and it's gangster rap because not all rap is bad. And does he not know that when rap first came out, it was positive, you know, but when the East Coast got a hold of it, it became gangster rap, you know, and it's all about the white record maker capitalizing. The white people make those records. You know, they're the ones that say, hey, we can make more money. Let's just get this out there, you know. That's great that you're talking about the cops and all that. Let's just sell, just like the horrible store owner who's going to put a plastic toy gun that looks like an AK-47 and sell it. You know, it all comes down to some people wanting to make money, but should not generalize the whole black race based on the people that he went to school with, because there are some blacks that don't act like that. You know, there's good and bad in every race.
Right.
And as far as the media, as far as black people demonizing the police, it's not that they are demonized. It's just that there is such a large history of black men being gunned down when other methods could have been used.
So,
other methods could have been used. You know, they didn't. Every instance that we've had recently could have been handled a completely different way, and those young black men would be still living.
Caller, thank you very much for your call. Melissa, I'm going to put this to you. let me take the caller's viewpoint one more. Let's say that I went to high school in Shawnee Mission District, and I didn't know anybody of color, and all I saw on TV was what we're seeing today. It seems like it would be even worse. I mean, I would just see black, and I'd have no other reference point other than baggy jean, most wanted on the TV, whatever. That would form my viewpoint.
Yeah, I know people don't want to believe this, but we do have gatekeepers in the entertainment industry, and they're not African-American people. I mean, let's just be honest. There is this overarching narrative of how we paint certain minorities in this country. And this is just a problem, and it's just a fact. We can talk about, that individual can pull up his bootstraps, you know, pull up himself by his bootstraps and just do something different. But we do have a certain amount of barriers to messages that go out there. Now, if you're at school and you have no people of color, and then you meet that one person of color, well, then you're going to build your worldview of that group of people around that person that you saw. I mean, but it is your responsibility to seek other information. So if you have a narrow view of one group of people, then the onus is on you to relieve yourself of that ignorance. Just like I would. I have friends in multiple groups, and I put myself out there to learn about people. I mean, that's my responsibility as a rational thinking person.
I guess, and I'm gonna ask you a question, and then we're gonna go to caller, and I'm gonna ask you to answer it. Is how do I know I've got a narrow view? Caller, you're on the air. What's your name, and what part of town are you calling from? Caller.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Your name, and what part of town are you calling from?
This is Rebecca. I'm calling from Midtown.
What's your comment?
I think one of the young callers that was talking about experience in college, I think one point I would make is that he admitted that he really didn't know that much about the history of racism. He's just sort of judging things based on his perhaps selective perception of the people around him. And I think that's an important point, is that you really owe it to yourself to know the history of racism before you make rash statements, and how this is just a continuation of a very racist society. I just got back from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I read about how the people of that city burned down the black community and lynched the members, you know, prominent members of that community, because they were very successful. I mean, and that's not that far back in our history.
So, caller, thank you very much for that point. I want to get to Melissa based on what the caller said. So Melissa, how do I know that I don't know? How do I know my viewpoint is narrow? And why is it that, shouldn't I almost be offended? Someone tells me, David, your viewpoint is narrow. You need to learn. I'm struggling with that. How do you get past that barrier?
How do you not be offended that somebody just told you were ignorant?
How do I know it?
Well, one way you can know that you might be ignorant is if you listen to and go the same places all the time, and you find yourself uncomfortable in a different place or listening to different information. That's a clue that you might have a too narrow of a viewpoint. So, for example, if I spend all my time reading Huffington Post and I don't read anything else, well, there's a good chance that I might have too narrow of a view, because everything that I read on that website makes me feel good. I owe it to myself to go out to Politico. I owe it to myself to go over the Slate. I owe it to myself to even look at the BBC and Al Jazeera. I owe it to myself, because if I'm just looking at one thing, I'm just going to get warm and fuzzy feelings because everybody's pretty much agreeing with me.
All right. I like that. Do we have another caller on the line? Caller, where are you calling from, and what's your name? Caller? Caller, what's your name, and where are you calling from?
Oh, my name is Rich. I'm calling from Overland Park.
Yes.
I agree with a lot of the discussion so far that there's a problem with, attitudes. My question is, as a person who lives in a real, in a segregated by race area, you know, real estate, that is to say our society, our city is divided by race physically, how do we interact with other races so that we can get a better viewpoint?
That's
or
a
more complete viewpoint?
Caller, what a wonderful question. Melissa, why don't you take that?
Want me to try to answer
that? Please.
Okay, this is going to sound... I really do have a light and kind of goofy personality, so that's going to come out. Our conversation has been a lot serious sounding this morning. But one thing that I've done when, because as a white person who lives in Overland Park, you probably never really have to remove yourself from that situation. And I mean, you're lucky. You don't really have to go outside of your comfort zone, so to speak. But as an African American person, I have to do this all the time. You know, I went to school and had to remove myself from my culture. I'm in a whole nother, you know, culture, and I have to learn how to be, you know, in that area. And so what I did was really, because it was culture shock when I went to college, because it was an all white atmosphere and I had been predominantly African American atmosphere. So what I did was I just started kind of listening to some of the things that white folks listen to, watching some of the things that they listen to, watch. And this is kind of trivial, but I started to kind of listen to different radio stations and watch different types of TV shows, because that was a lot of what the conversation was about. It's just social stuff.
Right.
You know, did you go to that concert? Did you hear that new song? And so I just started trying to diversify what I know so that I can participate in small talk. Now, you want to be careful with that, because you don't want to come off that, you know, you just watch some black show just because you want to meet, you know, someone African American. But I mean, you can just kind of open yourself up to other things that you wouldn't have considered watching or listening to or even going to, you know. If you're in Kansas City and, you know, and you're socializing at different places, you know, and you sit next to someone at the bar that looks different from you, strike up a conversation with that person. You know, you'll be amazed what you will learn at a bar. You know, David, I told you about the person I met in Nebraska. Do I have time to tell you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is something, but just let's set the stage for it. Melissa, I know you and your husband in Nebraska,
mm-hmm.
I guess predominantly white area,
mm-hmm. Very much
and
so.
It was a aha moment for you.
Yeah, it was an aha moment for us that has stuck with us since the point. So we're at a bar at a happy hour. This was pre our toddler, and someone is there who owns a brewery, and he's trying to get people to taste his beer, you know, to get new customers. So, you know, we're all about tasting beer. So we go over and we, you know, talk to him, and then he happens to come and sit by us at the bar. So we strike up a conversation, and this is rural Nebraska. And then we're, you know, city folk from Kansas City. And so, we start talking about guns. And so he explains to us how people in where he grew up in the state of Nebraska, there's many towns, but where he grew up, he said, you know, they got a rifle or a shotgun at 12, 13 years old. Everybody did, and everybody had one. And they would go home from school, and they would race home each other, different routes. They would race home, and they would have a contest on who can shoot the most squirrels. You know, and that was their fun for the afternoon after school. And so he's just explaining to us. And so then we tell him about guns in our community and how we have a problem with that, because people get angry with each other and they use them on each other. You know, we don't hunt in the city, or a lot of people don't go hunting, you know, they live in the city. Some people do, of course. But that was a real aha moment that helped us understand why the debate about gun control is so different between African-American people and between white people. Because we just have, by and large, we have a different culture toward guns. You know, white people tend to have them for sporting purposes and, you know, to collect them. And we're not talking about the fringe people who are like, in case of anarchy one day, I want to have a stash of guns. We're not talking about those people. We're just talking about regular people who have guns. They use them for recreation. And so we noticed that that's where this big debate comes from. But that's because you go out of your comfort zone and you talk to someone who's totally different than you and you learn something new. Not that our views have changed on gun control, but now we have a little bit more of an understanding as to why the debate is so heated.
Okay. Well, thank you. I like that. And I think going out of your comfort zone, you know, it seems to me if we go with the kind of the thread that's running through this, it's education and thirst for knowledge. And I think you put those two things together, it gives people the opportunity for that. And it seems like a lot of these issues may have solutions. We have a caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you from?
My name is Cedric, and I'm from Olathe, Kansas.
All right. What's your comment today?
Yeah, the comment is about everybody having the ideal of the clothes and the music and this, that, the other. I mean, we all have to sit down and basically learn, because there's really not anything said about kids who brandish rebel flags on their clothes or brandish rebel flags on their car or anything. And is that not a gangster or a thug or just a very bad ideal for the people who are in this country, you know? I mean, the dialect should be open, but I truly feel that a lot of people don't want to open that dialect when it comes to black history or blacks in general. We have been here, which I am. My son is a predominant basketball player out in Olathe. One day they were walking in the streets. It was cold. He was walking with four other white children, or should I say young men. He's a very tall guy. He was the one that they went up to and searched. He was the only one. I truly feel that there has to be some kind of psychological program run on any kind of policeman to see what their background is, see what their history is, see if they understand the basic understanding of what it is to be black in America, because we don't want to see that there is a wide span racist ideal here. My brothers and sisters and I, to keep it short, we went to California. We were raised around surfing and surfboards. I probably got a vast amount of music from Tool all the way to Bach. Hmm. And when I'm approached by certain people, white gentlemen or white women, they automatically have this aggressive type ideal that they have to be until they meet me and they say, well, you're different. I'm not different. I'm just me. This is who I want to be. You choose in what you want to be, and just like they choose in the ideal and where they want to be, you know. I just want to make the comment as far as isn't brandishing the rebel flag and all of these ideals still the same thing as thug life?
Caller, that you've made some wonderful points. I know Melissa is wanting to comment. Melissa, what are your thoughts on the caller?
Well, thank you so much for your call. This show, you know, needs to be longer, but you're right. As far as the, you know, no one should ever have to pay with their life because they choose a certain fashion. I mean, you know, they sag their clothes or they have a tattoo on their neck. That shouldn't be worth your life, you know, to where you're just such a threat and you're so low on the totem pole to where you can just be taken out. And to be completely honest with you, I have seen groups of non-black kids using the N-word as though they were darker than me. And I've seen them sagging clothes. Right. I mean, but what I think we all need to think about psychologically is what happens to us when we see a white person sag, and what happens to us when we see a black person sag? Are we going to say, oh, the white kid is just having a fashion crisis?
Right,
you know, he's having a moment.
He's going through a phase,
right, you know, but the black kid, you know, this is definitive,
right,
you know, of who he is. And that's really the crux of what we're doing when we're looking at people and we're stereotyping them. And the young man who said he grew up in a surfing community, you know, African-American community is not homogeneous.
Right.
You know, we have people that do various things and enjoy different things. You know, we're not all the same because we all happen to look alike.
Okay.
That's the problem with, I want to say one thing about the protests in Ferguson. So I thought a lot about this, of how to kind of attack this. So if you kind of think about worldviews, okay, so you have one group who has a worldview of I'm through with the system. The system doesn't work. It's not for me.
Right.
And then you have another one who is looking at the worldview and they say, well, it's a good idea. Let's make it a little better. And then you have another one who's like, you know, they're in the middle. Okay. Or no, they say that the system works perfectly. So you have system work perfectly, system doesn't work at all, and then system's good idea, but let's fix it. And these are the three worldviews that you have, and that's how you can be in Ferguson and have one group of people protesting, right, but at the same time have riots. Because you have different worldviews, and people need to agree with that.
Melissa, I first of all, I want to thank all our callers today. Time is short, so we cannot take any more calls. But if you want to comment, go to Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. We have, I think, 45 seconds left. Melissa, I want to give those 45 seconds to you. I really appreciated you being here. Some final thoughts on what do we do to move forward, and I think we're going to have another show, hopefully. But do you have any final comments you'd like to?
Yeah, my final comment is I've enjoyed all the discussion. I really appreciate all of the callers being honest and giving their point of view. It was a very healthy and lively discussion. We couldn't finish it all in an hour. I have much more to say. But I'd like for people to just challenge themselves, remove yourself from your comfort zone, and be open that people might be different than you think they are.
Thank you very much. My name is David Bell, host of today's show, here with Melissa Hasley. We appreciate everyone listening, and we look forward to talking to you again on Jaws of Justice Radio.
From the report of September 22nd, Joseph D. McNamara was the police chief of Kansas City and then San Jose, California. He was a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University and author of several great crime novels. The following from the July 1st, 2012 Century of Lies program.
Mexican drug cartels are driving the American drug market, and the whole nation of 100 million people on our border is on the brink of failure because of this crazy drug war. And I say crazy because I've had the pleasure of working with the late Milton Friedman, who was a Nobel laureate in economics, and he once asked me, he said, Joe, I can understand this war on drugs going on for a couple of years in a democracy, but how can it continue because it's so irrational? People have a demand for these substances, even though we as a society really condemn that and criticize it. Someone will meet the supply for that demand, and in doing so, we've created a black market, which really makes the drug cartels quite rich, buys all of the guns and ammunition and bribes that they need to make to sell their product. And why can't people just realize that this will never work? I had the pleasure of answering this great intellectual that it's because it wasn't based on rationalities. Just about 100 years ago, in 1914, 98 years ago, the United States passed something called the Harrison Act, which for the first time outlawed opium. And this was the first start of America's war on drugs, which we've spread throughout the world in a kind of arrogant and foolish thought that we can somehow control the world's production of these crops, these cheaply produced crops that become so profitable because we've made them illegal. We can control production. We can control shipment. We can seize shipments through interdiction. We can arrest people who use drugs in our country. We can put the drug dealers in prison for life. And it just simply hasn't worked for 100 years. And the more we try to do it better, the worse it gets.
Chief Joseph D. McNamara was also a speaker for law enforcement against prohibition. He passed from this earth on September 19th at the age of 79. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about. something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Plan for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beauticious Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio, KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta music. Okay.